SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
From Bally's Las Vegas, a very good Thursday, race fans. Sirius 219, XM 201, Sports Zone 964 if you're listening to Sirius XM Online. And at our website, stevebick.com, and inching closer, last chance, first chance contest later today. And apparently, heard from Keith Shamblin minutes ago, a record number of entries, over 500 entries for the last chance, first chance. Yeah, and a lot of that, you can have two entries. But still, it feels like there's a pent-up energy, a pent-up demand between the regular January, February timing of NHC and those that couldn't be here in August and in some cases transferred their 21 entry to 22. That included one of our invocation guests annually. He couldn't be here in front of us last year, but Roger Satina, skyscraper himself, welcome back.
Good morning. Thank you.
It's great to see you and one of the, in fact, both of the traditional, almost all, the only, you know who's missing? Doesn't matter. Grab a chair or Trey. Trey Styles is here too. There's traditionally been pretty much three early birds over the years. Roger and Trey and Tommy Masses. Tommy Masses also is a typical AM type that shows up. Should be you want to put that up, push that up. Is it already up? It's already up. So test that mic. There you go.
Yeah, is this working now?
It is working now.
All right, sweet.
There we go. And we say good morning to Trey Styles as well. Trey is going to slide a little bit further away from Roger just because now give me that mic for a second. Yeah, this mic is giving me some sirus. Huh. I thought I solved this yesterday. This is live radio at its best, right? You get this.
There we go.
Yeah, now it stops. I'm not sure what.
It's me. It's allergic to me.
No, it's not. You know what? I don't know what is. I can't figure this out. Ooh,
it's something else.
It's something else. It's not the mic.
Yep.
Thank you. All right. Well, so this is trial and error, I guess.
It's weird.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to work on this and figure this out. I don't. And this is not my strength either. when it comes to the technical nonsense, I thought yesterday when I fiddled with the mic that I had solved that. Wow.
I can't hear. Is it bad?
Well, it's not.
I guess it doesn't matter, right?
Well, actually, turn that off for a second. It is the mic. Somehow it is the mic.
Yeah.
Somehow it is the mic. That's interesting. All right. We will make the alternate arrangement because there's always. There's always another option. Exactly. Roger, give everybody a little bit of an update about it's 2 years since you've been here.
Yeah, 2 years. 2 years almost to the day, right? That's good. It all works now. It's 2 years. Couldn't make it last summer. Son was going to college, my only son, on Friday, day one, so that obviously wasn't going to work. But everything's good. It seems like the last 2 years are a blur. I'm sure everybody else feels the same way. But things considered, everything's good.
Well, and we talked before the show, and for those that don't know, Roger Satina, who has had as good a record, really, as anybody in recent NHC history. How many?
2 seconds.
2 seconds and
13 and 16.
Unbelievable. And Roger does the superstructure. Explain.
High-rise office buildings I built in New York City.
Does the girders?
I do the whole thing actually.
I always thought it was
no.
That you were the superstructure portion was
soup to nuts.
How about that?
Yeah. The only thing I don't do is the foo-foo stuff, like, you know, the tenant fit-out and sheetrock and painting and wallpaper. I'm not a wallpaper guy. Shocking how that might be.
I did not realize that.
I've built probably 7 or 8 high-rise office buildings.
How many projects? Manhattan? Typically, how many projects at a time?
Usually 1 or 2.
Wow. How much more room is there in Manhattan for...
Oh, there's plenty. Yeah, there's plenty. As long as the people come back, you know, there's plenty.
But with this post-pandemic office scenario, what's the office space, you know, rental scenario?
You know what? It was really bad for a while, but it's starting to creep back.
Unbelievable.
I think a lot of people have realized that they can't really just do it from home. And New York is funny because... Part of the allure of working there is actually being there, too.
No doubt.
Right?
No doubt.
It really is. And I think at the end of the day, you know, a lot of these bigger companies, will, they may have some staff that's not in the office, but a lot of the higher up type, and they actually want to be in the city. You know, they don't want to be home. It's weird because it was very quiet for a long time, but it picked up in September like nothing ever happened.
Like a switch, like throwing a switch.
Just the switch went back on. And the market is, it sounds like it's coming back. So
unbelievable. Because it sure seemed like, you know, the era of
I mean, even the residential market went in the tank, right? Like, because everybody ran away. And you know, for a while you could rent something really cheap, and it was cheaper to buy. And now it's went right back to the roof again.
Well, a lot of people from the city and the environs came marauding up to upstate.
Yeah, absolutely.
Came
Vermont,
up our way. And bought up every you know, every single one is going to be it's going to be sequels to the Bob Newhart show. opening bed and breakfasts in every nook and cranny.
Exactly. But yeah, I think New York at the end of the day is too big to fail.
It's good to hear.
Like AIG, too big to fail.
I feel bad. You were one of the few people that benefited from no cars going through the tunnels. You live in Jersey, so the
traffic was great. You didn't even have to tap on the brakes anymore.
And then, thump.
I mean, I have a picture of 12 noon in Times Square in April or May, and not one car, not one other person. I'm just standing there, and there wasn't a soul.
Jesus.
Pretty unbelievable. It was that crazy. The only people you saw were the people from the hospital ship that docked.
Oh, yeah.
On
Hudson
River. I mean, that was it.
Wow.
It was nuts.
Amazing. Wow.
Totally amazing.
How ready you did... How much horseplay has been going on in the meantime for you and to get ready for this?
Oh, yeah. I've been here since Tuesday. You know me, I lock myself in the room and study. Yeah, you're
me
the same
too.
Way, Trey. Yeah.
Monday.
I'm basically done with Friday already, and I started on Saturday. Yeah. I have to prepare. There's no other way.
Agreed. Well,
and the early arrival, all I do is broadcast, but I can tell you, getting here early... Yesterday, after walking the strip, I walked all the way down to Resort World. Frank Miramonte wanted me to go to Resort World, so I did, and then walked all the way back. And it's a considerable. It was nice. It was a couple hours, you know, on the hoof, and you know, had the long trip in on Tuesday night. I slept literally. I think I woke up twice, but I slept 13 hours.
Wow!
Which for me, that's two and a half nights sleep
for
me.
Sure. Yeah.
So I getting here, I've said for a number of years, getting here a day earlier than you had planned is always worthwhile, particularly if you're an East Coaster. I mean, you're coming two time zones, right?
Correct.
And Roger, you and I are three time zones. But especially if you're not somebody that is used to a West Coast that switchover, because it can take you out at the knees.
The time, the switch in time, and then just the, I don't want to say just excitement, but I think, well, I got to get up and get cranking. I got to get studying.
The adrenaline.
I was up this morning at 4. You know? Yeah, exactly.
The adrenaline's crazy.
Can't do anything about that, but yeah. I think it helps getting out here and knocking out at least the time difference.
Yeah. Yesterday morning, like 2 a.m., I'm drinking coffee and like handicapping. Yeah. I'm like, this is just insane.
That's my typical scenario. And I think what happened last night, I'm going to be able to actually, instead of laying down at 7 o'clock at night here and knocking out, I think I'm gonna be
start adjusting.
Better set. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
I just stay on my old time most of the time.
A lot of people do that. Yeah, it's an either or.
Thing. Yeah.
Advice then for those that are on their way here. There's a lot of I know there's people listening because I hear from them every year. Advice for them if they're traveling today and gonna dive into it tomorrow. How can they be better prepared for the, especially if it's their first time tomorrow.
I think you have to stay on your own time. If you're coming in that late, like from the East Coast, there's no way. By the time you adjust, it'll be over. And you'll blink your eye and you'll be like, what happened?
Yeah, my first time I came out the day before and I was totally out. Between the excitement and the time lag, I tried to, anyway, I was up at like 2 in the morning going for a jog down the street. I needed to do something, right? I couldn't sleep. So it's, I agree, totally agree with that. Try to stick with your regular routine as best you can, but. Like you said, I think getting out here as early as you can is the way to go. But at this point,
it's a little late for that.
Yeah, you got to do what you got to do.
For those that also are potentially, they're certainly going to play 2 days, the Friday and Saturday, with hopes of making Sunday. Give them some advice in terms of the expanded format and making the decisions that will that will get them to Sunday.
Do you know the answer to that one?
I think, I love to play the long shots and stuff like that. With this way racing is these days, they're far and fewer between from what I see. It's gotten a little tougher. I think you just got to pick a number and try to get to it in those 2 days. That number is probably about 250 to get you where you need to be to get into Sunday. That would be my advice. I think you have to look at a number. I'm always swing for the fences, right? Shoot for the moon and take the sky.
You and Ray Arsenault are probably the two most prominent home run hitters in that regard. The George Foster approach
and usually what happens is on Friday I won't have a good day because it'll be a lot of short prices and I'll be annoyed. So. This year, I always say I'm going to switch it up a little with the two entries, but who knows? We'll see.
We'll get to the two entry question, and for you, Trey. I mean, you've always been somebody. If I'm thinking back, you've always been somebody that has a number in mind and is using building blocks to get there.
Yes, but I've changed the way I've approached it. I think at first, when I first came out, I did pretty well my first trip day out. I finished 30 something, which is okay, but I had no chance of winning. And so I realized that, and so I figured, okay, I got to start shooting. And I think I overcompensated for a while and started just shooting too many wild bombs. And so I kind of found a mix a couple years back when I made the final table, I guess 3 years ago, especially the first day. I figured out on that Friday that there just weren't prices. So I took short price horses that day, and I got about the same score both days going totally different approaches.
Explain what that kind of price is. Nine to two types.
Oh, well, it just depends on that day. I don't think it's true as much looking at the Friday card. I think there's a little more long shots this Friday than there was that year. So I'll probably will go a little longer this year. What is that? It depends on how much I like it. I mean, it's like how long is a piece of string, right? It just depends on the string. So I don't know that I say, well, I can't play that one because it's 5-1, or I can't play that long shot because it's only 10-1. It's just depending on how I analyze the race and how, you know, if I think that's a good play based on the odds. And that's just going to – day one, I don't really try – I don't even look at the leaderboard, don't care about the leaderboard, just stick with my picks. If I'm 0-15, I'm still playing the same strategy. I don't care. I don't adjust anything the first day. And then so my odds plays don't – the second day I start having to – you know, reality kicks in, and I started got playing things that maybe I wouldn't want to, or vice versa. Maybe I could play some horses like the year I did really well. I could kind of stay on track. It was nice for a change to finally have a weekend workout where I could do that.
One or two tickets.
I have two this year.
Okay, Roger with two as well. What's your two ticket approach?
I want to hear Roger's two ticket.
Well, he has finished second twice.
I know.
In the last 9 years,
my best year was when I was kind of lamenting that I didn't have to, and I only had one, and it was great. I didn't have to worry about splitting picks on different entries. I mean, I'm not gonna say I'd rather have two, but I think I'm gonna kind of. A lot of the optionals, at least early, I'm going to try to double them up and play the same entries, same horses, maybe spread out in some of the races that were mandatories. If there's two I like, maybe spread out. But I think I'm going to try to keep them kind of aligned, at least to day two, and see where that gets me.
Raj?
So if you look, I went through all the races Friday, and I think I have 32 races that are probable, interesting.
Right.
What constitutes an interesting race to you? What is the construction?
Something that I can look at and have four or five contenders, and then win the post parade when they come on the track, and depending on the odds and how they look in this, then I can make a decision. Right. So most of them are actually mandatory. That's what I was looking before. Except for those couple Santa Anita races, the third race at Santa Anita. I don't know where that came from.
Yeah, exactly.
But the other ones are all like ones that I actually really was interested in. So that's good. And just whack them off as they go. But the reality is with the optional ones, with that, I'll probably take what I usually do is I'll separate the bets, and I won't use the same one on both tickets. I'll use the most logical winner on one, and then the longer priced one that may be not as logical on the other. But there's just so many races, you can't look at every race. It's impossible.
Do you, as you look, and for instance, I'm going to put up, you mentioned the mandatories. The mandatories are out, and I'll put it up on Twitter for tomorrow. Oaklawn second is the first mandatory. Fairground second, Gulfstream eighth, Santa Anita third, back to Oaklawn for their eighth, the Santa Anita 5th, 7th, and the last mandatory tomorrow at Golden Gate, the 8th. And that's at 4:25 Pacific time. So basically 7:30 for us. I'm just estimating when we'll be on the air. I'll figure that out. But obviously, you know, all afternoon. And it looks like there's an intense period where... Boy, there's one an hour late for the late action for Santa Anita and
I guess they wanted to keep it.
Golden Gate.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah. I'd have been in my room otherwise, I think.
Well, exactly.
And, I actually liked the last race at Golden Gate. So.
Yeah.
Well, we certainly have to be on by 4 and, you know, 4 to 8 probably, and maybe even a little earlier. I'm going to guess that... I'm going to guess we'll be on from 3 to 8 tomorrow night, okay, on streaming on the website. I hadn't really thought about that until seeing this because we'd like to, you know, you like to wrap up Friday and have a handle on the leaderboard in the first day. So I'll put those up. But the tracks, contest tracks for tomorrow, Aqueduct, Fairgrounds, Golden Gate, Gulfstream, Laurel, Oaklawn, Santa Anita, and Tampa. And, you know, for instance, today, Gulfstream, they're off the turf. that's going to be a new wrinkle potentially over the next couple of days. Yeah. If anything comes off the turf and Gulfstream, it ends up on the Tapeda to deal with, plus Tapeda races that are already scheduled.
They'll probably be off the turf tomorrow too, I would think.
More. Well, there's that race. That race is a turf race. The 8th.
No, it's actually synthetic.
Is it on synthetic? I saw the. Let me see. I printed. I didn't.
It says Tapeda. That's it right there.
How about that? Okay. Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. No, mine. No, this says. Oh, that was Fairgrounds that I saw. Okay, that was Fairgrounds. Yeah, Tapeda is right. 1.70 a pricey. That's interesting.
It's a good race,
starter
actually,
handicap. Yeah,
it's very interesting. Yeah.
How about that? All right, so they're not afraid to tie in right away to the using Tapeda.
No, I mean, them putting the Tapeda in, I don't know. To me, it was a good idea. I think they made the right move.
Do you, and on a regular basis, do you play Turfway and Woodbine?
I definitely play Woodbine, yeah. I kind of liked the Tapeda at Gulfstream because the fields are sometimes bigger and there's no Pletcher horses, thank goodness.
That's funny.
Because
that's interesting.
Anytime he's in a race, you just turn the page because I just wanted to beat myself over the head trying to beat him. It's just insane this year. It's like, it's crazy.
I've only really watched the maiden races and the stakes. I mean, I have not been engaged there at all. At all.
Since Sam Houston started, I don't have much time to do much beyond that, to be honest. So I'm looking at that's kind of could be a problem for me this year because I haven't played any of these races as much as I normally do. But
well, and you know, that's an interesting that you bring up an interesting element. You know, talked this week with Rich Migliori and with Andy Serling, and you've had this pronounced speed bias at Aqueduct that, I mean, they've had now 3 days, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday here to maybe, you know, work the track and try to, you know, get the we'll see what happens, this week. But, you know, in some cases that not an advantage per se, but it's something to play into your, you know, into your thinking. And, we talked quite a bit going into Friday at Fairgrounds with the situation that that they were going to face, that the inside turf course, when they took down the temporary rails, you ended up, it turned out that had a very soft inside. Usually that ground is pristine and a great path. And, you know, the advanced thinking was it's going to be boggy down there. And that, so you know, a lot of that kind of intrigue plays into this and how, you know, people have their favorite circuits. One of the things about the mandatories that's always entertaining is that it pushes people outside their comfort zone, whether it's route races, sprints, turf sprints, whatever it might be.
Absolutely.
What's the talk about your mandatory approaches.
The mandatory approaches, that's where I'm going to really always look for the longer price, I think. It all depends on the race. You know, sometimes you just got to hold your breath and take a short price. And
exactly.
Hold your nose and not watch.
It's nothing worse than the bomb you were thinking about in a mandatory coming in. And two-thirds of the room has it, or it seems feels like it at least.
That's why if you have two entries, it makes it so much easier because you can, again, take the most logical winner and take the most logical bomb.
I would agree with that.
Well, because there's always been, it seemed, two schools of thought. I've even had people like the Matisses say, you know, just pick the horse that is the most likely the winner. I mean, just pick a winner, period. And then, of course, if it's also, you know, if it turns out that there's somebody that is so low that it, you know, that the $5 and change isn't going to, you know, or $6 isn't going to make a difference in the long run. You know, there's a danger in that thinking, isn't there? When you say, well, I it's okay if the 2-to-1 wins, but then when we get down to cut lines, $6, you would give your teeth for a $6 increase.
Yeah, a few years ago I made the cut because it was a mandatory race, and I took some Navarro horse that was like even money, and like held my breath when the race went off. But I wouldn't have made the cut if I didn't use them. Yeah. So, I just hate betting chalk.
You're just
He's cringing right here.
Oh, it just gives me the chills.
People can't see this, but I'll say that it's true. He's cringing.
It is. There's no, you know, Roger, you know, the other Ray Arsenault is the other one. Yeah. I mean, Ray would take and he doesn't care if it's. He doesn't care if it's well beyond a cap horse. If it's a 48-1 shot, it absolutely. Well, the greatest was when he walked up last. I want to say last year. It was last year. It was months ago, in August, when he walked up for that last race that Justin Mustari won, and didn't bat an eyelash, picked that winner, and said. You know, but and he wasn't even saying it from a question of well, that's the contest play, the idea of a contest play versus a good bet. He said that's who I'd play. That horse is going to win. At whatever
it was, the five horse. I remember because I liked it too. I played it too. I wasn't at the final table, so but.
And was what it was 20 something to one?
Yeah, it was a big one.
Yeah. Yeah, that's his style. Kind of funny. We're going to have Nick. I think Nick's going to join us. You mentioned Sam Houston and Trey. It's been a good start to the meet as you and I talked. And I don't know if you saw. You must have seen it. You joined me last week, and. You know, the tendency when you look at cards is, you know, let's go through the card, and you say, well, I've only got one horse that I'm interested in. There's really only one horse that not only does it win, and I think was the fourth choice, won by the length of the stretch. I mean, that was a Born, B-O-E-R-N-E, Born.
It was Bernie, yeah.
Bernie, yeah.
Correct.
No, that's right. They pronounced that horse, that's Bernie. Right. And so I had to point out on Twitter, I said, that's Trey Styles in a nutshell. he's not gonna scattershot, and he said there's only one real play today. Horse wins, pays $850 or give or take $860, and one, I mean, like a 2-5 shot.
And Nick's asked me several times on air, like, what? Because you had me on once. I had a 37-1 as my top play of the day once, and you had me. I just look for. I try to go along. I mean, it's unusual that I go that low odds. And in fairness, that the field scratched down. I think it was at least two scratches in there.
There were two.
So I was hoping to get a little better, higher odds. But I just thought that was the best play. And so, you know, for the value that was there, the odds that were there, and that value term, Nick and I have talked about that a lot. It doesn't mean long shot. In this case, it was a 3-1 or 9-2. I don't know what the odds were on that one, but. That's where it was. So that's all I had for you.
There was actually a second horse that you noted that was a big price that I think ran third.
Yep, you're correct. Big, like a big shot. I want to say like 30-1 or something ran third.
Exactly. And so a great tri-key horse or somebody to juice up the exact. And Nick Tamaro is joining us now. And first order of business, of course, is to reiterate how everyone thinks about Nick and his mom and the family as Patriarch Pat Tamaro, after a valiant fight against cancer. Nick, for everybody, just, you know, thoughts and love and appreciation for your dad.
Thanks so much, my friend. I appreciate it. It's been a big help in the last week or so, seeing and hearing everything. It really has made a tough time a lot easier. So I can't thank the racing community enough. And, you know, for all of our disagreements amongst horse players and various other stakeholders in the game, one thing that's true is that I think people generally care a lot about each other. And then this was a great example of it to me. So I appreciate it tremendously. And we're going to toast him this weekend, and it'll be good. It'll be a good time.
You're going to call today with the return to action at Sam Houston. Then, you know, family gathering Friday and Saturday, but then Sunday for the big card, the Houston Ladies Classic and the Connolly back at the mic. And, of course, I'm sure appreciative of the ubiquitous Chris Griffin, who getting an early start on calling at every racetrack in America this year. He's already
he's
up to three.
Backup. Really. He is definitely. I didn't want to call him racing's utility infielder because he could show up anywhere. But I mean, he is like the best pinch hitter ever.
He's America's race caller.
He really is. Yeah, he should travel around as part of like a band. But yeah, no, it's very nice of Chris to come down. I don't think that his arm had to be twisted terribly much to get out of what could be 2 to 20 inches of snow in the Northeast on Saturday.
That's a good point.
Good time of year to be in Houston. It is supposed to be an absolutely gorgeous day in Houston on Sunday as well. It's supposed to be 65 and sunny.
Well, and Nick, there's a real chance, I think, that we won't know till probably Saturday morning, but or Friday night. There's a real chance that the Connolly or the Classic is part of the final, part of the mandatories at the least.
That'd be great. Yeah, no. Hopefully that's the case. I mean, they're good competitive races. The Stoner Sites Sprint that comes up after the Connolly is also a really terrific race. I wasn't sure if it fit in time wise with what the committee might be looking for. I mean, as far as the Ladies Classic goes, we're also waiting on a potential upgrade, which we'll hear about in the next couple of days, because the Graded Stakes Committee is finishing, I think, their activity today. So the other thing that I wanted to make sure everybody knew before we got into any kind of larger conversation is that we're going to mandatory pay every multi-race pool, pick five, pick six, and also, most importantly, the jackpot high five, the Houston high five. So it will be a mandatory payout in race 11 on Sunday. And, you know, the carryover is already almost 40,000. So, I mean, that could end up being a relatively decent sum. It's offered every day on the 3rd and the last. So it'll be on the 3rd and the 9th today, tomorrow, and Saturday, and then the 3rd on Sunday. And everybody just do us a favor and don't hit it until the race 11 on Sunday.
with Trey here, we should probably Trey was going to come down anyway and hang out, but with you, Nick, let's maybe touch on a quick coverage of Sunday.
I have not looked at anything.
You haven't looked at anything Sunday yet.
Any Sam Houston questions?
Okay.
So.
Well, Nick, then a couple of quick thoughts about the Classic and the Connolly and such.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Ladies Classic hardly has, you know, the depth that you would hope for from a race of this caliber, but, you know, it's also a division that doesn't really sort itself out until a little bit later in the year. The headliner is Pauline's Pearl. You know, Pauline's Pearl ran a race in the Zia Park Oaks that speed figure-wise was at a level that she really hadn't been at prior. And I think that's why she's going to get the bulk of the wagering support. But I think as far as the race itself goes, in terms of dynamics, the Mary Rose potentially has this field over a barrel pace-wise. And she comes in off a tremendous win in a money allowance race up at Oaklawn. And you know, John Ortiz is a trainer that has not only shipped to Sam Houston with success, but it seems like he pretty much goes anywhere and can win races. So I think Ray Lou's coming back for the ride. I think this horse is very dangerous. And if they allow the Mary Rose to get a comfortable lead, she might be really difficult to reel in. The Pulse Power Turf Sprint only has a field of 8. It's a very good field because Archidust is really a top-notch sprinter. He's nearly a Graded Stakes caliber sprinter. And then you have Bad B. Bryan, who comes in off a win in one of the Claiming Crown races. That it was just a very impressive win. He came from deep in the field after getting in a little trouble on the turn. So that's a really exciting matchup. I made Bad B. Bryan, I think, the 8-5 morning line favorite. And the Bob Bork Texas Turf Mile, the first year it's named for Bob Bork, who was the president of Sam Houston for years. And his son Dan, of course, is in the racing office at Churchill Downs and was helpful in terms of recruiting horses and getting connections involved in this race. So it's really nice to see. And this is a fun race. Todd Pletcher sending Chanceau, who nearly won the Dania Beach last time before he got run down by his stablemate. Mike Maker has a slew of horses on this card, including a trio in here. And I think the most interesting of them might be Grantham, who is trying turf for the first time, son of Declaration of War. The second dam was a turf winner overseas, and it looks like this Colt's going to get a pretty big pace to run at. So got big fields left and right. It's a really fun card, and I think there's going to be some great wagering opportunities. We're going to do a pick six on the 6th through the 11th. That's going to be a mandatory payout. I mean, it's a standard pick six. And then the pick five is going to be 7 through 11. There's going to be a pick five on races 1 through 5. And, of course, the high five will force out in race number 11.
Sunday at Sam Houston and even all the way to the end to that turf allowance. Just a dynamite slate put together. And we'll undoubtedly, I'm gonna guess that there's going to be some Sam Houston inclusion on Sunday here at the NHC. In terms of today, Nick, and Trey, anything for today for you?
I don't play the last chance.
And, no, I mean for Sam Houston today. You didn't.
Haven't looked. That's no problem. I'm totally focused on the NHC.
I got you. I hear you.
Sam Houston.
Nick would be too if he was here. And but Nick, how about today for those that are going to take part?
Well, I would be feverishly scowling in the corner with my iPad, waiting to make the morning line for Sam Houston, but then probably wouldn't do much more than that. But there are a couple of spots I thought that were a little interesting, and one of which was in the 5th. I like the 2 Mishko for Miguel Angel Silva coming back from a short layoff. He made the only real off-the-pace move in a race where the speed really held up well. Last time out at Remington, a Newport Beach who won that race came back and ran really well at Sam Houston last Thursday night, finishing 2nd behind Conviction Trade finished 3rd. He did all the dirty work in that race. So I think Mishko's a horse that you can upgrade. I think he's going to get maybe just enough pace to run at. He'll be a fair price, 7-2 on the morning line. You do have to approach that morning line with skepticism the entire time. And then the other horse that I thought was interesting, this one's going to be a big price. Trey and I talked about this last Thursday night. I think the rail on opening night was a big problem. And Bold Legend, the 8 in race 6, was all over the rail. And so I think she's a big upgrade cutting back in distance. So now she's going from that mile to 5.5. Which is a pretty big cutback, so it worries me just a tad. But I think she can settle and make one run. I think she's really interesting at what should be a pretty big price. That's the 8 in race number 6.
The 8 in the 6th, Bold Legend with Mora Dupuis. Excellent. First post, 4 o'clock Central, 5 o'clock Eastern at Sam Houston today. And 9 race card. Nick, I don't know how much time you've got, but I've got Roger Satina here as well as Trey, and we were kind of roundtabling NHC, and of course, you're always self-effacing when it comes to this contest, and always everyone appreciates and defers to your prowess at the BCBC as an offsetting mitigating factor.
Yes, that's factual. What I can say is the NTRA is definitely on my holiday list at the moment. Michelle informed me that given the circumstances, they were going to allow me to transfer my 2022 entry to 2023. So I'm very, very pleased that I might be the first qualifier already for the 2023
NHC.
Nice.
That is pretty good.
But yeah, very, very pleased, very appreciative of Michelle. But my 30-second rundown on the NHC, and then you can talk to people who've actually done well in it. it's totally unnatural in terms of preparation and requirement because nobody that has even a modicum of success at the racetrack goes and bets on 8 tracks in a given day, right? Or even maybe 4. But it's about, and I'm sure Trey and Roger can certainly give you better examples of how to do this, but I think I've at least felt best about my level of preparation for it when I went through every race with a quick, 1 to 2 minute initial look and determined what I thought were my types of spots, maybe from a race flow perspective, or the first thing I would do is evaluate the favorite, because if you look at the favorite and you can spend 2 or 3 minutes doing this and you determine that this looks like a very strong favorite, well, then you're not spending any more time on that race. So I would say that if you have a preference as far as surfaces, if you have a preference as far as distances, if you are somebody that loves to play pace collapse races, there are a variety of ways that you can. I always make a spreadsheet and run down each track and color-coded depending on what kind of pay scenario I think it is. And if I think it's one that's extreme one way or the other, I'm immediately going to go back to those and start there. And then what you want to avoid are situations where you end up looking at races where you like multiple horses. Because I feel like every other horse player, I always make the wrong decision. Right, I always choose the one that was maybe the shorter price, or I choose the longer price, and the shorter price wins, or this and that, and you can't, the mental exercise in that contest is so significant, and it seems to last, you know, so long that you can't get yourself beaten down on Friday. And the difference, of course, being that that is a contest where, you know, live money contests, you can't really win or lose them on Friday. You can lose the NHC on Friday. You can put yourself in a position where it's almost completely impossible to get back in the mix. So, you know, don't make it that much more difficult on yourself. Give yourself the opportunity to still be in there pitching away, and always make adjustments as far as what you need to do in terms of prices. You know, play your horses, and if you have some success and you can start to get into maybe a lower price point that brings you some comfort, go for it.
Yeah. It makes perfect sense. The whole thing, the only thing I say I wouldn't agree with is if you like multiple horses in a race.
That's what I thought, too. Same thing.
Yeah, that's the reason why you want to bet those races.
Agreed.
I like multiple horses in the race. And with two entries, I'll split it up. Other than that, I totally agree, but... Yeah, if I have to, I can't play it like a pick and pray and just like this horse in this race, that horse in that race. I always look for the races where if there's 9 or 10 in there where I think half of them or 4 or 5 of them can win, that's what sparks my interest.
And the times you do well is when you're lucky enough to hit to get that one instead of the scenario that Nick just described where you get frustrated that the other one came in or... I totally agree. Yeah, if you've got some beatable favorite or favorites and there's 2-3 that you like in a race, 5, if you find a price in there, take a shot and hope you get it.
Absolutely.
Nick, along those lines, other advice for, you know, for anybody that is doing this, particularly for the first time, because I hear from so many people on the lead up to the contest that, you know, are you know, particularly excited about you know, making it, and it is funny. There's always a few stories. There's always a few first timers who absolutely catch a wave.
Yep.
How do you quell the nerves and the excitement?
I mean, I think getting yourself into, I mean, guys like Roger and Trey know this certainly better than me and have done it better than me, but I mean, I think you've got to take your general handicapping routine and just expand it, but stick with what you generally do and, you know, don't try and reach for things that you might not generally look at. But determine as quickly as possible how you can handle the handicapping part of it. And I mean, the biggest thing is, to me, is stay in the moment. You know, that was one of the things that I kept saying to myself during the BCBC in 2014 when I got to the lead was, you know, I also reminded myself to enjoy it because, I mean, there was a pretty decent chance that I might never be in front in the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge again in my life. I didn't win. I finished fourth. So far, I'm right. I haven't been in front again, so, I mean, I was standing in the paddock of Santa Anita thinking, you know, this is unbelievable. I had $3,000 this morning. We're just after the sixth race, and I've got $35,000. So, you know, that's something you have to remind yourself because, I mean, one of the things that's clear about the NHC, and there's no argument about it, is that if you're there, you're good. You did something right, right? You may have just had a day. It doesn't matter because that was your day that you really connected on something. So, yeah, I mean, don't let the contest get bigger than it is. It's already big and difficult enough. And take your process and just expand it as you feel comfortable with doing because, you know, you are proven enough to go ahead and keep doing it that way and have success.
I would add, that's very good. I totally agree with that. I have some very good points. When people ask me, I get that question a lot, you know, for new timers or some people seek my advice and... I think get out here as early as you can, as early as your work and family limitations allow, and don't give up, don't panic, early, especially on Friday. Like I said, I don't even look at the leaderboard. Don't care. Don't panic. Even on Saturday, don't panic. Stick to your plan. Stick to what you do. It just like in regular day at the races, you're going to go through some streaks. You're going to have some good ideas that don't pan out. So don't panic. Stick with your game plan, and don't just start shooting at long shots for the sake of long shots until you absolutely have to.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. The leaderboard on Friday is totally irrelevant. Totally irrelevant. Again, find that number and try to get to that number. That's really what you need to do.
I'll agree with what Nick said, though, too, about don't. I don't know that you're – I mean, there's people every year, too, who totally stink it up the first day and come back and win or cash really high. So I don't know that you're totally out of it, but I do agree to put yourself in a spot. I mean, pick your number, but, you know, if I can get – If you break even, at least you're in position the next day. I mean, don't panic and start trying, well, I got to get to 120 or whatever your number is, and start painting plays that just aren't in your wheelhouse. So,
and just stab.
You know, the thing that I feel like on that topic is I feel like the most people that I talk to that are playing in it, that have never played in it or have played in it, you know, maybe once or twice with little to no success, the first question that invariably they ask is, how low can my odds go? You know, what's the shortest price you would take? And I mean, I tell them pretty much every time, you know, I don't know what kind of player you are. I mean, if I was talking to somebody that I would say to them, if you regularly find 20 to one shots plus that you bet to win or that you really think you can make a strong case for winning, then I mean, you should just be doing that. But, you know, I would say the majority of us are much more comfortable finding 8, 10, 12 to one shots that we can make reasonable cases for, and I think you can definitely be that successful. So, I mean, I generally don't walk around and ask people what horses they take, but I know there have been a lot of people that have had a tremendous amount of success doing nothing but taking long prices, and then there are people that have had, I know the 1 year I did respectively, I had an 18 to one shot on the first day and then took a bunch of horses between 6, 8, 10, you know, 12 to 1 in that range. So I don't think there's any kind of hard and fast rule that anybody should try and you know, adopt. They should really stick with what generally works for them and try not to go too far outside the box.
I was going to ask both, actually, about tools and about the methods, because that's something that that is so different. And it was funny that when we had Joe Costello, you know, who won the tour.
Right, right. That was a great interview.
Mm, and Joe, you know, when I got to this question, he said, "Well, I use the PPs." I was like, "Oh my God!" I mean, you want to talk pure? And you know who else was like that? Chris Littlemore. Chris Littlemore is strictly a past performance tool. That was his method. Same thing. But you know, Nick, I can't remember the last time you and I had this discussion. What, you know, and maybe it's slightly different for the contest because there is time constraint. I mean, to have to look at so many races. But what is the, you know, the method in terms of going through and identifying, and how much adjustment do you make to your normal handicapping process when you're here?
Yeah, I mean, I think you definitely accelerate it as much as you can while ideally not trying to get too far away from what you do successfully otherwise. But, I mean, I utilize on a daily basis handicapping Timeform US and DRF, primarily Formulator. And I print my PPs out of Formulator. That way, if I've made any notes and trips and things like that, they're visible. So, I mean, you know, I know people that spend a month or so before watching as many replays from different places as they can to get trip notes, people that are concerned about trips more than others, and you know, that seems like a good idea. It also seems like something that if you don't have any success, you think, man, I put a lot of time into this, and it really didn't pay off. So, I think that whatever you can do to accelerate your normal process is ideal. That's why one of the first things I would do is go through the pace scenarios, looking at the pace projectors on Timeform US, and if it looked as if it was going to be extreme one way or the other, I immediately flagged that race to be one that I would come back to. I would also automatically go back to any of the turf races at Gulfstream and Tampa and Fairgrounds, and because generally, you know, those are going to yield better prices. And so, I mean, I don't, and I'd actually love to hear if Roger and Trey do the same thing. there are usually at least two tracks that I don't look at all because I can't. I mean, I don't look at Golden Gate. And so, I mean, unless it got to the 11th hour and got a little desperate. But, and I didn't generally wouldn't spend a lot of time on Laurel. But, I mean, Laurel's racing has been a little bit better some other years. Of course, the weather in the Northeast is going to be rough on Saturday. So I don't know whether it's highly doubtful there's going to be racing at Laurel or Aqueduct. But, yes, I generally wouldn't even look at those cards. But it's about comfortably accelerating your process without leaving out anything that's important.
I would say when he was talking about not incorporating new things into your handicapping that here, I totally agree. Because I tried that some, maybe I thought, well, you know, this is the big time when I first got here. I better start, you know, upping my game. And I started trying to incorporate things that I just wasn't familiar with. It didn't work at all. So I'm a formulator guy. I like to manipulate the data using that, using formulator. And that's what I do normally today at the races. So that's what I do here.
So I think personally, there's way too much overload on information. It's just way, way too much. And like you could just get caught up in it. So I do use Formulator and Thorograph, and but I think you got to trust your own opinions. You got to trust your eyes. Like watch replays and just look for certain
love
things.
Replays. Yeah,
just look for things. I saw a few things that may or may not pan out, but there may be a lot of screaming in the first race at Gulfstream on Friday. That's all.
I think I'm in that one too. We might be screaming the same way.
And Nick will recognize this direction I'm going to bring up. Not to discount the trip handicapper approach and philosophy, but I've kind of taken a I don't want to call it a stand. To me the trip handicap concerns and finding the horses that had trouble, quote unquote, is, for me personally, the time. The time investment, I can't make it, and I certainly if I'd gone in the direction to go after the contest scene, I struggled early just a couple of times, and then I found it affecting my day to day play, and so I sort of just became kind of an observer, and I'm how much I love it and love coming here to do this, but I maintain that, for starters, when you're finding horses that had trouble, there's a reason they have trouble, because they're needing to pass seven or eight horses. So if the trouble that they had last start, it doesn't preclude that they're not going to have the same exact trouble passing seven or eight horses next time. And except the problem is everybody saw the trouble, and so the price that you deserve to have on a horse like that is now been muted by the fact that everybody's aware of the trouble, and they have a tendency. This is like picking that kind of horse in the Derby. And of course, now it's even harder because there's no pace anymore because there's no speed horses.
Oh, yeah.
But still,
jockeys that want to go to the lead.
There's another problem.
Say there's no speed horses.
Well, there's no Trinibergs.
Yeah.
But, Nick, we've had this discussion, and I'm sure Andy's not listening, but I'm sure Andy would throw up to listen to this. But to me, it feels like I would rather have a horse that's sitting second or third and I know has got the capability based on figs and on performance and form that is just not going to have to deal with passing seven horses.
It's not only trouble, though. You have to look for not only trouble, but sometimes you have to look for intent. And, like, that's something.
Well, there's
like,
subtleties, no doubt. There's subtleties, and there's race flow, and
like,
there's
you and
there's
there and you
the
look,
track.
And then you're like, and you look again. Right. You're like, wow, that was interesting.
Yeah.
Nick?
Yeah, no, I think you're making kind of two different arguments, but I don't. I mean, if from the perspective of wanting to avoid running the risk of betting on horses or picking horses in a contest format, they're going to have to do big things in terms of race dynamics and stuff like that. I mean, the majority, not for long, but the majority of racing in this country is on dirt. And if you find yourself regularly playing deep closers, then, you know, you're going to be into sports betting pretty soon. Because it's just not, you know, you're not going to survive.
Oh, yeah.
So it's going to be very, very hard. So I totally agree with that sentiment. And I think the point that you're making is a totally valid one, which is that it's also, see, somebody, a player of Rodgers caliber is going to know how to look through the PPs and find the trips that he wants to watch. And then he's going to watch those trips and make a determination if those are horses, in my opinion, or my guess. And believe me, feel free to tell me if I'm wrong. But then that's the biggest part of it. It's not even, the trips are not even the big concern to me. It's the race watcher that really has to be careful with it, because if you're looking for, you know, if you're looking for studied comments and running line comments that make it a red flag to watch that replay, well, every Tom, Dick, and Harry is watching that replay.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right? I mean, that's the point you're
making.
You've
got to think
out
of the box.
Thing. So, you know, I want to look at the way races unfolded, and I want to watch the replay of a race where it looks to me like a horse came from well off of it, and then I go look and see that they were the one-two finishers were 1-2 all the way around the track. This was the only horse who made the move. Or I want to look and see a horse that maybe withstood a pace situation that was extreme, and the winner came from deep in the pack, and this horse really, you know, really stuck it out all the way to the end. I want to find those kind of horses. So, I mean, to me, that's not necessarily trip handicapping in the terms of I'm trying to find trip horses that had trouble, but that's a race flow type of thing, and I think that's the, you know, how races are run is the most important way to it's the most important thing to look at in terms of analysis.
Absolutely.
Right.
Well, I just, you know, it to me it you know, on a regular basis I mean, I understand, particularly when Andy has the conversation, the way the track played enters into this, and the way and you know, horses that were, you know, very much up against the racetrack and the race flow, which is different than trouble issues, and so that portion. But at the same time, if you aren't familiar with a certain circuit, Nick, and have, you know, the day to day understanding of the way, you know, the way that materialized, that isn't something you can necessarily just go look at a circuit that you don't follow and understand. And I would think that the time investment in researching it, although, as you mentioned, you know, the people that for a month have already been watching, you know, every race that conceivably could, you know, then affect these next 3 days. So I suppose it's possible, but it's a mammoth undertaking. But at the same time, if you find one or two plays, you know, each of the days, it could be the difference maker.
Absolutely.
It'd be great, but like you were saying, I don't have time to do that. 30 days out, I can't go through all of the Oaklawn races. I just can't. The only track I really follow every race is Sam Houston, and that doesn't do me a lick of good here, no. Except till maybe Sunday.
So maybe Sunday.
Maybe Sunday. There. But it's just, there's, you know, for me, it's a time factor. I just can't do that. So generally, my entries, I'll watch, right, you know, it's my regular play on a much lower scale than one in trying to, you know, follow every race at a certain circuit. If I see something as I go, I try. And I do probably 2 weeks to 2 months out start paying extra attention to races and thinking, how can this horse come back and help me at the NHC? And so, you know, I'll make notes. And but otherwise, I can't. I'm with you. I don't have the time to just do that.
And
wish I did. It'd be great.
Yeah, I watched a lot the last month before.
Yeah.
And was able to put, you know, a few pieces in. And it just so happens the first two races at Oaklawn were two of the ones that I'm waiting
Sweet.
For to run back. So
nice.
When I opened those PPs up, I was like, ooh.
Look who's here.
Look who's here.
Well, and Nick, it's probably an excellent exercise for everybody, you know, in terms of, you know, being the kind of player that pounces and you know is keeping, you know, from a record standpoint and you know, keeping notes and you know, we certainly know people listen to the show and you know, listen to the trainers and hear comments about developing horses and so forth, and you know, the habits and practices of you know, a successful horse player come into play.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's you know, if you are somebody that has a process that involves a lot of race watching and setting yourself up with notes and things like that, like Roger alluded to, then you want to do that. But you definitely want to stick with what, you know, makes you a successful type of player. I think one of the things that keeps and has generally kept me from being as successful, and maybe it's because I just became a chalk-eating dog being a public handicapper for so long, is that, you know, the horses that I like to bet that generally I find on a regular basis are 9-2 and 6-1, you know, in those types, they're not necessarily big prices, and so that doesn't do you quite as much good at an event like the NHG, but you certainly can make, you can make some hay if you do have some big prices that you can sprinkle in as well. So, I mean, I would say that's part of the process, again, that you don't want to stray too far from if you have a comfort zone. And the other thing that, you know, as Trey was saying, it's hard for people to have time to do that kind of preparation ahead of time. And, I mean, I've said to a lot of people, also be careful about which tracks you're playing. You know, if you don't regularly play Aqueduct in the winter, then don't bother now. I mean, obviously. And, I mean, for me, I'm a notoriously terrible Southern California handicapper. So, I mean, I don't generally get too involved there. But, yeah, so I try to keep it simple. I think keeping it simple is the most important thing by far.
Nick, before we go, any thoughts about the confrontation at Gulfstream on Saturday?
I'll be honest with you. If they run the races that I feel like we have seen frequently enough, I don't think there's a chance in hell that Nick Skill can beat Life Is Good. I think Nick's Go is a very talented horse, very good horse. I think he is also a monumentally dressed up horse. He has gotten one very easy lead after another. Life Is Good is much faster than him, and I would imagine Irad is going to make Joel's life as difficult as possible going into the first turn. And there's certainly a situation to me where, you know, he sets himself up outside, much like Charlatan did in last year's Saudi Cup, and Nick's Go will definitely succumb to that pressure, in my opinion.
It does seem, and you know, I know people are noting the draw, but it didn't seem like that would be any different had Nick's Go even drawn outside of him. In that, if he had drawn outside of him, then he would have been put on the defensive chasing, just as difficult.
Yes, absolutely. I totally agree with that. I don't. You know, the draw was always going to be. It's probably better for Nick's Go to be on the rail because they only have one way to go, as you're kind of saying. Because if he was outside, he would have had to work that much harder to clear. And
yes.
And he's just a total need the lead type. Whereas I know it hasn't necessarily happened. I have a great amount of confidence that the Life Is Good can sit outside of him and go on with it. I mean, that's the Todd Pletcher training program. That's how he always has his horses conditioned. And you know, this just in: Todd Pletcher's very, very good in Florida. So I wouldn't want to be messing around with a horse of that caliber for a trainer of that caliber at a track that his horses perform and produce at as frequently as powerfully as they do.
How what do you think the early fractions are, provided they can be timed properly?
Good luck with that.
As I finished retiming 25 races from across the country during our call, I would say 45 and change. Probably they're going to go fast. Those are two fast horses. You might as well not fool around. I mean, so they're gonna move. You know, figuring if it's a normal type of surface, yeah, it could be 46, and that wouldn't surprise me. And the thing is, those two will be able to go on with it because they're very fast, and that's not gonna keep them from kind of withstanding the pressure.
Nick Tamaro, everybody, and Tam 1215, and Nick will be tuning in later for the return to action at Sam Houston, and then, of course, Friday and Saturday, Chris Griffin and Jessica Paquette is going to call some races as well. And everybody will be thinking about you, and in regards to the opportunity for those that want to pay tribute to Pat Tamaro, the TRF donations to TRF are being suggested. Anybody else, Nick, that your dad would like people to thank?
The official cause of his obituary is MD Anderson. So, I mean, if anybody wants to make a donation to MD Anderson Cancer Center, they're doing amazing things and always have. So, I mean, I firmly believe that based on some of the research and work that they've done over the years, we got the 7 months with him that we did from his diagnosis. And he was basically diagnosed with a two-stage cancer that he was essentially at stage 2.5. So, I mean, it was very, very advanced. And so his doctor in particular in the Thoracic Center has really done an incredible job and is world-renowned in terms of some of the work that he's done. So, yeah, if you feel compelled to, go ahead and give to MD Anderson because, I mean, their slogan is making cancer history, and it's true. And while, you know, it's the result there generally isn't great, and in our case it wasn't, it was still about the time and opportunity and experience that we had along the way.
Nice. MD Anderson is one of the great cancer facilities around the country. And Nick, best wishes, and we will we'll talk next week, right? We'll let you get through this weekend.
Absolutely. I'll be back on the beam. I appreciate it, my friend. Good luck, guys, on the call and everybody else. I'd be fine with a Satina Styles exact. I'll box it.
Yeah. Put me down now. I love it.
Nick Tamaro, everybody. Let's do this. We'll take a break. Roger Satina is with me, as well as Trey Styles, and two of the traditional kickoff visitors, and particularly good opportunity with Trey and his presence on the SHRP, Sam Houston Race Park shows, the Sharpie show, which was so clever, putting SHRP to work. I told Frank Hopp they got to get the Sharpie highlighter.
I heard that interview. That wasn't you're on, right? How could that not have happened already?
I know that it's a marketing natural. We're at the fully decorated ballroom. When I was talking to you yesterday morning, they were putting tables up. And by the time I got down here this morning at 5:30, everything set and ready for action. The Last Chance, First Chance contest. And as we go to the break, here are the specific numbers. And they're unbelievable. 532 entries today.
Wow.
Which is easily a record-shattering number. There will be a record 24 seats. Yeah. Put in for this year and 3 for next year.
That's great.
24 last chance winners in, and some will be a second seat, and others will be getting in at the last moment. 35 races to consider: Laurel, Gulfstream, Aqueduct, and Fairgrounds, and 11 must be played, 4 mandatories, and 7 electives. The mandatories, the Gulfstream 6th and 8th. No, the Gulfstream 6th, the Aqueduct 6th and 8th, and the Fairgrounds 8th are the mandatories. Today, back with Roger and Trey here at Bally's, soon to be rechristened, by the way.
The Horseshoe.
Horseshoe, much like the rechristening of Indiana Grand. We'll talk about that, and I'm sure we'll talk about that with Caesars people as well. Back after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only 3 states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL...